Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, 1 year on from U.S. President Barack Obama's discourse to Muslims in Cairo, we talk to Egypt's ambassador to the Holy See about some of the challenges that remain in the West's relations with the Arab world. As the year for priests draws to a close, we talk to one young priest about his ministry in these times of trial for the Catholic Church. But first, the prestigious Path to Peace Prize is awarded to the president of the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences and Harvard Law professor Marianne Glendon. Archbishop Celestino Migliore, the Holy See's permanent observer to the United Nations in New York and president of the Path to Peace Foundation, announced this year's award recipient. The foundation was established in support of the Holy See's permanent mission to the UN and the activities of the Vatican in the search for world peace. Marianne Glendon is a former U.S. ambassador to the Holy See. She teaches and writes on bioethics, comparative constitutional law, property, and human rights in international law. In 1994, she was a signer of the Evangelicals and Catholics Together, an ecumenical document aimed at rapprochement between Catholics and evangelicals. Glendon became the first female president of the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences when she was appointed by Pope John Paul II on March 9, 2004. She had been a member of the Academy since January 1994. And in 1995, she was the Vatican representative to the International Beijing Conference on Women, sponsored by the United Nations. Also receiving honors from the foundation, Kevin Ryan, president of Covenant House for Homeless Children, and Peter Kelly, president of the Crudem Foundation for its management of the Sacred Heart Hospital in Milo, Haiti. A New Beginning. That's the title of U.S. President Barack Obama's groundbreaking speech to the Muslim world last year at Cairo's Al-Azhar University. In a panel discussion on the first anniversary of the discourse, June 4th, Vatican diplomats said that while there has been much progress in the dialogue between Christians and Muslims since then, much must still be done on both sides. The panel discussion came one day after Bishop Luigi Padovese, the apostolic vicar of Anatolia, Turkey, was stabbed to death by his driver, who had been undergoing psychiatric treatment. He has reportedly confessed to the crime.
Sono profondamente addolorato sulla morte di Monsignor Padovese, che ha anche molto contribuito per la preparazione del sinodo. Raccomandiamo alla bontà del Signore la sua anima.
While on his way to Cyprus, the divided island of Greek and Turkish Cypriots, Pope Benedict on Friday expressed sorrow over the tragic death of Bishop Padovese, but said it should not cast a shadow over the dialogue.
We should not stop from hoping for a better world.
A member of last week's panel, Egypt's ambassador to the Holy See, Lamia Mekhamar, said Christians and Muslims should not be discouraged by such violence or by events like the bloody Israeli raid on a Gaza-bound aid shipment May 31st. Such incidents, she says, should make us even more committed to seeking alternative solutions for peace.
We should not stop from preaching good ideas all over the world, educating people and the young especially. But of course, there is a very important need to create the environment where this dialogue could be undertaken. And of course, the environment is only created when the politics put in place are just and recognizing the rights of people to exist on equal parts.
lamenting the loss of human lives in the Gaza ship raid. The U.S. ambassador to the Vatican, Miguel Diaz, said, "This situation in Gaza and other parts of the world demonstrates the need for dialogue and reminds people that we have to expend much effort for dialogue and common action in order to resolve conflicts." Another panel speaker, the director of the Pontifical Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies, Father Ayuso Guillot Miguel Angel, urged that education across the globe become an instrument to teach peoples to respect the other and every individual's right to practice their faith with full freedom.
The implementation of the speech of President Barack Obama has to be understood in a globalized view, since his speech doesn't refer only to one person, to one country, but to a globalized ideal that is the one of peace, of human dignity, and therefore here for its implementation there is a felt need of a real commitment starting from every person for building peace and from every institution and also at all the different levels, political, diplomatic, financial, etc.
Recent foiled terror attempts in the U.S. by young Muslim men have some people wondering, though, what more can be done to prevent young people from turning to extremism and violence. Ambassador Mekhamar says both the Islamic world and the West have to accept their responsibilities.
I think the roots of all these acts of violence come from exclusion. Exclusion, whether in their societies, because maybe these boys, young men, are living difficult economic conditions, or also exclusion by the outside world, which happens in many Western countries. In many countries, they did not do much in order to integrate these people. And this feeling makes them really frustrated, and they could resort to violence easily. They're easy victims to this kind of attitudes.
So how should the West act to eliminate the injustices and correct the perception that this is a conflict of the West versus Islam?
As I mentioned before, it's not action needed only from the Western world, but also from the Muslim world. But if we are going to mention the Western world, of course, there are politics which need to be revised towards our part of the world. These injustices, these wars that are not necessary, that really made the lives of people very difficult and the suffering very disseminated in our societies. This is why I think the West, from its part, should revise its politics. This is for one. But on the other hand, of course, as I mentioned, sometimes the difficult economic situation makes people without hope. And that's why they resort to violence. So maybe helping in bringing up the economy and maybe spreading education is also very important in that regard.
Democracy across the Middle East is a big issue. How important is that for peace in the region, in the Arab region, and peace between Muslims and Christians, the Arab world and the Western world?
Well, democracy is one of the ingredients that I mentioned in the Obama speech, and it's maybe one of the most important points mentioned in the speech. Democracy may be maybe also one of the ingredients of the environment we're talking about in order to the dialogue to take part. The dialogue is in itself a result of a democratic process. So, of course, democracy is very important for people, not only young people, but for everybody to express himself freely and maybe to express himself in other ways than violence.
With the war in Iraq, democracy became, in a certain sense, a bad word across the Arab world. So how do you find the right sort of democracy that is adaptable for Arab societies?
I don't think democracy has become a bad word in the Arab societies after the Iraq war. What came as a bad word is imposing certain models of democracy where people are not yet prepared maybe for to absorb and react with these models. And I think education is essential in that regard. You need to educate people in order just to be aware that they're going through a new process, that they can express themselves without violence, that they can interact together without being hostile to each other. So it's still a very important point. It has not become a bad word in our part of the world.
Father Angel remarked on his experience of living 20 years in Egypt and expressed dismay over the way he said some Arab media portray Christians in a negative light, often lumping them together with the West and creating in this way misconceptions and mistrust between Christians and Muslims. Father Angel was indirectly suggesting that the media may be partly to blame for acts of violence or intolerance against Christians in the Middle East. I asked Ambassador Mekhamar how important it is to get the positive stories across.
Well, the positive story is Egypt, though still we are not excluding that some acts of violence and some acts of exclusion are committed towards Christians in Egypt. This is a fact. Some incidents happen, but they're scattered incidents. The reality is that the Egyptian society lives in harmony. Christians and Muslims are both Egyptian citizens. Christians are represented in many ways, in, I think, in a very good way in the Egyptian society. The Minister of Economy comes from a very important Christian family. The Minister of Environment is also Christian. Most of the biggest businessmen in Egypt are Christian, and they work freely. They earn money without interference from the government or from Muslims. So I don't think it's a real picture or depicting a real picture to say that the Christians are persecuted in our part of the, I mean, I'm talking about Egypt, of course. But there is also one point I would mention is, or I should mention, is that there is also a lot to be done. Yes, of course, there are practices that need to be changed, laws that need to be modified. And this is done, but, you know, in a pace that could be accepted by everybody.
Are these changes that the government is considering at this moment?
Absolutely, absolutely. And some of them are already in course. Some of them have already been introduced. And, for instance, the laws on building churches now, which Egypt has been criticized for years, and it was a law by the Ottoman Empire, I mean, during the Ottoman Empire. Now it's being changed. Now the Christian feasts are a national feast for all the Egyptians. So, I mean, and many other changes, really, are introduced, positive ones.
And a warm thanks there to Egypt's ambassador to the Holy See, Lamia Mekhamar. Three days of liturgies, reflection, and witness begin in Rome Wednesday, bringing to an end the special year for priests that Pope Benedict announced on the Feast of the Sacred Heart of Jesus on June 19th last year. Some 10,000 priests from more than 90 countries are descending on the Eternal City for the events to give thanks for their vocation, recall the dignity and responsibility of priestly ministry, and to renew their communion with the Holy Father. So, how are priests living out their vocation in these times of trial for the Catholic Church? I sat down with young Franciscan Father Edwin Paniagua to find out. He began our talk with a reflection he wants to share with his brother priests.
All in my experience is to really root their lives in the Eucharist and devotion to Mary. In my experience, it has been a source of rejuvenating grace in my own personal priesthood, because I have found from experience that if my life is rooted in the Eucharist, if I have a deep devotion to the Eucharist, this goes back to Fatima, the apparition in 1916 when the angel taught the children Eucharistic adoration. If that it permeates my entire life, coupled with a deep devotion to Mary, you make it through thick and thin. Your life is filled with graces and happiness. Our Lady protects you from all sorts of dangers, from all sorts of traps that the evil spirit places before you. Because remember, there is such a thing as a devil, there is such a thing as temptation, as the Pope mentioned, even in Fatima, when he spoke to the priest that evening, when he met with religious deacons and priests and so forth, he said, you know, you need to learn how to resist the temptation of the devil. You need to know, to realize he's a real entity, and that was like, etc. What comes to mind is the vision or the dream vision of Don Bosco, in which he saw this beautiful image of the church, the bark of St. Peter, going through rough waters, and all these other smaller ships attacking the boat, another attacking the ship, attacking the church. And he notices that there's two major columns in the sea. One was for the Eucharist, and another column was for Mary. And he says if the church manages to anchor herself between these two columns, she will be safe. She will make it through thick and thin. She will be anchored. She'll be solid, you know, in her witness, in her life, in her mission that Jesus entrusted. But that's not just for the church as a whole. This is for every individual, whether you're a priest or not. If your life is anchored between the real love for Christ and the Eucharist, I mean, when you go to Mass, you're participating fully. Maybe you go a little earlier and you just adore Jesus in the Eucharist. Before you leave that Mass, you pay him a visit. Lord, thank you for the Mass. Or maybe you're driving by a church one day and you have time to pay Jesus a five-minute visit. That's all part of, you know, living out the Fatima message as the children were taught. But also, you know, you pay a visit to Mary, an image of Mary, you put it in your room and so forth, you say prayers to her. You try to squeeze in, as John Paul II said, at least, if possible, he says, you pray a rosary every day, at least. If you can't say the whole thing at once, you can spread it out throughout the day. Maybe say one decade in the morning as you're driving to school or to your work. You send a second decade. And then, you know, maybe coming back through a third and fourth. And maybe, and then before you go to bed, maybe you pray the fifth decade with your children, you know, that one decade or that fifth decade with your husband. So you're incorporating that prayer life in your life. And it's like oxygen to your lungs, to your spiritual lungs, and strengthens you. And you make time for meditation that tranquilizes you and quiets your spirit, and you're able to face the stresses of the next day, and so forth. So that it's an art. It's that's part of the beauty of it, and that's my advice to all priests based on my own experience. But you have to be very careful because Jesus said in the gospel, "You are in the world, but you are not of the world." And not long ago, recently, the Pope gave a message to the Roman Curia here, in which he was telling them, you know, to be careful not to be of the world, but you are in the world. And I remember that's one of the answers he gave to a question shortly after he was elected Pope, when someone asked him, says, what's your take about the abuse of minors and all that? And he said, well, you know, I think that in one of the factors says the priest has become worldly. Many priests, not all, but many have become worldly. And we have to be very careful with that because, again, we are called to be like Jesus. We represent Jesus. The priest is Jesus walking on earth. And we have to reflect that healing. We continue his ministry. Priesthood means we carry on. Jesus established, look, at the Last Supper, he says, I can't be here physically until the end of time. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to be priest of you all so you guys can continue to do this in memory of me and continue to carry on the ministry of healing and of grace that I have started until the end of time.
Father Edwin has been a priest for some 10 years now. What does his ministry mean to him today?
The priesthood has been a very powerful experience for me because I realized that a priest is one who represents Jesus here on earth. Jesus, first of all, is the high priest, and he left us an example to follow the way he lived out his own priesthood. And if you look at Jesus' life and how he lived his life is how priests should live their lives. It's very simple, you know, especially in the element of sacrifice. A priest is someone who is sacrificing everything for God and for the people of God. The whole life of a priest is one continual sacrifice. And if that is offered and lived out with fidelity, with purity, with love, it produces a lot of good fruits and a lot of graces of salvation. I mean, like for the story of Fatima, the children were called to, everybody is called by Our Lady to make sacrifices. Well, the priest in a special way is called to make sacrifices and to be a sacrifice for other people. Because, you know, Jesus says in the gospel, and the apostles realized when they were making this choice of following the Lord, they were amazed. Lord, you know, look, we have left everything to follow you. And Jesus says, but I assure you that everyone who has left father, mother, brother and sister, and land, country, and home to follow me will receive on top of that, will receive many homes, many fathers, many mothers, many sisters. And on top of that, he says, eternal life.
Do you ever feel lonely, though? You've left all these things behind.
I mean, we all have our moments of loneliness. I mean, I can't say that, you know, well, you know, we, no. I think all of us, I mean, I had my moments of loneliness, things like that. But it's natural. I look upon it as natural. You know, am I really lonely? No. Because really, the source of that of not being lonely is the conviction that the Lord is truly with you. First of all, Jesus made it very clear, first of all, that we leave, as the gospel says, we leave homes, we leave brothers and mothers, sisters, fathers, and everything. But we get in return for all that, tons of mothers. I mean, you know, the times that I worked in pastoral ministry, you know, there have been tons of mothers who are about my mother age who have adopted me as their son. And, you know, they fed me and sometimes overfed me, you know, and they just surrounded me with love, you know, and they gave me a mother's hug, a mother's kiss. Jesus, and there's tons of them, you know, and so many, especially those mothers that says, oh, how I would love for my son to be a priest. You know, they sort of adopt you, you know, I say. And then you have all these people, young people out there who are into their faith, who look upon you as a brother and you are, they're your sisters and brother and all that. And they also surround you. So there's really no, you're not really alone because you're surrounded by so many wonderful people. But you can still be very alone. Despite all these wonderful people around you, you can still be very alone if you don't have a deep relationship with the Lord. I mean, that's the source. I could be living in a community of 50 people, still very, very experience great loneliness. God created us in this way. There's a certain emptiness in each of us that only God can fill. So no matter how much we seek for pleasure in academics, in relationships, in you know, out in drinking, or in sex, or in technology, or in all these different things, none of that will really make us really happy, because God, there's a certain emptiness in the soul that only God can fill, and only God can really make you happy, because we're created in His image and likeness. When we die, we go back to God. This is why, you know, it's important to have a deep relationship with Christ. So the priest who's not really close to the Lord, and I would add, also has a deep relationship with the Blessed Mother, because Our Lady really, really looks out for priests. She really has a special love for priests because they made that sacrifice to follow the Lord like the apostles did. We left our families, we left everything, you know, to follow you. If you have a deep relationship with Christ and His Mother, you really are never alone. In fact, the loneliness transforms into solitude, which is a positive way of looking at that time alone with the Lord, in which you listen to His voice and in times of quiet with the Lord. It becomes something very, very positive, something you cherish very much.
Father Edwin, as you can tell, has a very special relationship with Our Lady. He wanted to start his ministry with a visit to Fatima, Portugal, where she appeared to three shepherd children in 1917. One of these children, Lucy dos Santos, later became a nun who continued to have visions of Our Lady throughout her lifetime.
Sister Lucy, if I'm not mistaken, once had a cousin who wrote to her and expressed his desire to leave the priesthood. And she wrote this marvelous, wonderful letter that I remember reading, and I was just struck by the depth of it and how substantial it was.
What did she
in
say?
Which she explained to him that the reason why so many people and why consecrated souls and priests especially give up on their vocation, what they're really being called, is because they stopped praying, because they allow their relationship with the Lord to weaken, because they allow that relationship, that the closeness with the Lord, that communion with the Lord to die out. You know, it's because they don't pray. And it's very dangerous. When we stop praying, we stop communicating with the Lord, because prayer is communication. You know, my priest is like being married to God. So in a marriage, if there's no communication, if communication breaks down, the marriage will break down. We need to communicate with God. Spend time before the Lord in the Blessed Sacrament, for example. Heals you and gives you powerful graces and gives you the strength to carry your crosses every day, to bear with the sufferings of life. And you're really never alone.
Let me ask you this. You're talking about the sufferings of everyday life. This has been a period in which the Church, the Catholic Church, has suffered a lot, especially over the sex abuse crisis.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Of minors. How has that made you feel as a young priest?
First of all, you know, Jesus said, you know, the gospel, that scandals will be inevitable. There will always be scandals. But he also says, woe, however, to those who caused a scandal. It would have been better for them to tie a millstone around their necks and throw them and hurl themselves into the sea. But when I first heard of this, of the sexual abuse that broke out in the United States. I was ministering in a parish ministry at the time in Canada. I was really sad. I was sad for the victims, for sure, absolutely, because, you know, the victims are innocent, and, you know, we're talking about children and the innocence of children. You know, that is a given. That's understood. And I was sad for those very priests who had fallen into such a terrible sin. It was a crime. And also I feel sad for the church because it mars our image. There was a sadness about it, you know, a sadness, but also a sadness that is coupled with hope. Because as John Paul II said, okay, society is right, this is a crime, and this is a terrible tragedy for the lives of the priests themselves, or whoever did it, not just priests. You have to keep in mind that the statistics, we're talking about the total number of priests that have fallen into these abusive minors is 1%, according to the experts. But the media makes it look like, you know, it's the whole of all of the church and all the priesthood. But it's not so. But at the same time, I can understand the reaction of the people, and I can understand the pain of the victims, because that 1% of priests is earth-shattering. Fine, we can expect, you know, the doctor, the teacher, the police officer, etc. But a priest, a religious, it's shocking, because you're talking about a man of God, you know, whom people...
supposed to imitate Christ.
It's Jesus on earth, exactly. Mm-hmm. We present Jesus on earth, and people see, yes, they see Jesus. I mean, I remember when I was walking through some of the Catholic schools, and I was in my first years of priesthood, and the children would ask their mother, "Mommy, is that Jesus?" You know, and the mother says, "Well, you know, he's like Jesus. You know, he follows Jesus. You know, but it made an impression on me, because children look up to you, and they have this image of God as being such a good God, a wonderful God, and then the priest represents that and reminds us of that."
You know, I've talked with a lot of Catholics, and some of them have expressed concern, you know, that their trust has been undermined in their priests.
Well, yes, and that will take time to heal. You know, I'm sure there will be a phase where people will sort of have to, you know, the church will have to win back the trust of some of the people. It depends on the person as well. You know, like just recently the news, even the secular news revealed that the Pope's popularity despite all the attacks on the person of the Pope. You know, the people are still convinced that he's been doing what he can, even when he was cardinal, to try to stem this from happening. And the popularity of the Pope still increased. So it varies. It depends on the individual. But it takes time to heal. And the Pope, John Paul II, said it beautifully one time. He says, yes, abuse of minor is a crime, but now we hope that the result of that would be a more purified and holier priesthood. So now there's a lot of norms in place. Now there's an awareness, even in seminaries, to accept men who are healthy and in religious orders, and both men and women, you know, that to make sure that people are coming in to minister to the people, to work with the people and with children, are healthy people, come from healthy families and so forth.
When you say healthy, you mean psychologically?
Talking about emotional health, mm-hmm. you know, effective maturity, mm-hmm. Healthy mental health, emotional health, psychological health. People who, you know, have a good upbringing, good morals and principles and all that, you look for those good qualities, because they will be working with people and children. You want to make sure that they, you know, are a good example. The Pope just said, you know, remember when he was heading towards Fatima, he was responding to reporters about, you know, the issue of abuse of minor. He says that the sin comes from within the church. The church is divine in her foundation, because Jesus, the Son of God, founded, but she's human in her members. So there will be, and he also explained it so beautifully on another occasion, in which he said the very fact that there was a Judas among the 12 shows us that there will be moments of infidelity by some, you know, priests and so forth, that, you know, that they're not all going to be perfectly holy and so forth. Mm-hmm. But we hope that this is minimized tremendously by bringing all this to light and dealing with it, and also fixing where the fixing needs to be done.
And a very warm thanks there to Franciscan Father Edwin Paniagua. And I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.